You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. This is part two of SpyCast's interview with intelligence legend Felix Rodriguez.
I want to ask you now about a very successful operation. That's Bolivia in 1967. You trained and led a team to track down, now even more so, one of the most famous revolutionaries of all time. And unfortunately, he's more famous today because in the 1990s, every other college student had a picture of Che Guevara on their sweatshirt. But you were sent down, you got intelligence that Che was operating in Bolivia, and you were sent down to train and lead a team to chase down Che. And what I found interesting from reading your book about this was the way that you went about building dossiers about all the different rebel leaders. So it's a classic intelligence technique, but you really kind of hunkered down and made sure you really understood the people that Che was operating with.
Right. Well, the reason why they selected us was because there was a prohibition from U.S. Ambassador Henderson that no U.S. personnel could participate in areas of combat or danger, because Vietnam was already taking place. There were American troops coming back in plastic bag, and they didn't want that to start happening from South America. So that's why they selected Cuban, because we were not U.S. citizens. So Larry Sternfield came to Miami, he interviewed like 18 of us or 16, and he selected two of us. And then I asked him why he selected me. You know, at the end of every interview, because we basically had the same training, he will ask us and say, well, if I select you, when will you be ready to be mobilized? And everybody will tell him, okay, I need a week or whatever, or 5 days or 2 days. My answer to him was, if I have time, I'll go to my house, I get my clothes, I say goodbye to my wife, I come back and we leave. If we don't have time for that, you give me the phone, I will call my wife now and tell her I have to leave. And if we don't have time for that, let's go, I'll give you her number, and you call her and you tell her I have to leave. And I guess that impressed him to the point that I selected me out of the other 16 or 18 people. So we went to Bolivia. There were already about three Cubans in La Paz working with the Ministry of Interior, helping them in intelligence. And then the two of us, with one American who was our boss, we went to, first of all, when we arrived in La Paz, we were taken to President Barrientos' home, personal home. He gave us ID card for our support from the armed forces and the civilian. And then at 10 o'clock in the morning, we went to see General Alfredo Bando Candia, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, who gave us a similar ID card. And by the way, about 2 months ago, I donated those two cards for the CIA museum, the original one. Mm-hmm. I just kept copies of it. And the last ash of shade that he smoked before he died. So we started operating there and working. I remember reading when I was in Washington about the different guerrilla that were given to us. We were given the photograph that was painted by Ciro Bustos. We given the dossier from DeBray, what DeBray wrote about it. And then we learned, I knew, for example, from there that Paco José Castillo Chávez was one of the guerrillas who wanted to leave. Paco was a communist, but he was never briefed that he was going to be a guerrilla. Actually, he was told by the people who recruited him, he was going to be going to Cuba and the Soviet Union, and he was a communist. He loved that. And when he arrived to this area where he thought he was going to be putting in a small plane and flowing into the Uruguay, and from there given documentation to go to Cuba and the Soviet Union, he was given a rifle and told that he wasn't a guerrilla, and he was no guerrilla. So at the time that he was actually, by coincidence, captured and wounded, he wasn't even carrying any weapon. He was carrying food and ammunition for the rest of the guerrilla of Juan Vitalio Acuña Nuñez, Joaquín, who was the guerrilla that was decimated completely by a military unit of Captain Mario Vargas. So I knew that Paco would be a tremendous prospect if we ever got a hold of him. So when he was captured and he was brought in alive to Valle Grande, I accompanied a Major Arnaldo Saucedo, the head of intelligence, and when I went to see him and start talking to him briefly, the guy had a tremendous memory. We will be able to recite the meeting that took place 8 months before and give you the address and give you the name of 16 people. I mean, he had a tremendous memory. So I went back to get the army to give it out to us for interrogation. At the time that I arrived at the headquarters in Valle Grande, Lieutenant Colonel Selly was talking to General David Lafuente, the head of the army, and telling him this guy knows nothing. I already interrogated him. He was the order. We already told the press that he was badly wounded, I mean, to kill him. At the same time, I then spoke to the general and told him that I believe that his information will be very important. I also told him, if the information we get from him you don't believe is important, I will never ask you for another prisoner. Now, I have met General David Lafuente in a meeting that we had at the training place at La Esperanza, where the Special Forces were training the Special Battalion, on a visit by General Robert Porter, the Southcom commander. And he knew that our relationship with the Army, we had those ID cards from the president and the commander-in-chief. So he did order this guy to give us the prisoner. So we took Paco to Santa Cruz, and he was able to give us actually how Che will move, which was instrumental to verify when he was in the area. He told Che will move in three groups, vanguard, center, rear guard. The vanguard was five or six guerrillas. He gave us the war name that they had from those people 1 kilometer ahead of him. And then 1 kilometer behind was the rear guard, with another five or six guerrillas. So in case there is an ambush from either way, Che was protecting the middle. He could maneuver out of the ambush without being hurt. So later on, in late September, when Lieutenant Eduardo Galindo Arteche was able to kill three guerrillas near Pucará and Higuera, and we were commissioned to go there and pick up the bodies, when I arrived and I spoke to Lieutenant Galindo, he told me, mi capitán, I had the rank of captain, he told me, mi capitán, I saw the guerrilla in the distance. When I started preparing the ambush on top of the hill, they surprised me. So that, and then the three members that he killed was members of the vanguard of Che. One was Coco Peredo, the head of the Bolivian guerrilla. The other one was Mario Gutierrez Jardaya, a Bolivian doctor. And the other one was Miguel, who actually was a Cuban captain, who later we learned was Manuel Hernandez Osorio. Now, with these three bodies, knowing who they were, knowing they was from the vanguard of Che, I was able to convince Colonel Centeno Anaya, who was the commander of the A Division, that the Che was in the area, definitely explaining what happened. And the battalion still had about 2 weeks to be operational. I mean, the basic training was completely finished. It was a matter of shooting, getting medals, diplomas, and all of that thing. So he did terminate the training short, and they mobilized the battalion, who actually were in operation on the 1st of October. And now what they use, they have four companies of less than 200 men each. One company is staying in Valle Grande to maintain communication and support, be able to feed them with food and ammunition, etc. One company was commanded by Captain Lopez Layton, and he was deployed along the Rio Grande Ravine so that the guerrilla will not move to the other area. Even though this battalion could operate anywhere in country, they had identified very closely with the 8th Division. And the other side was the 4th Division commanded by Colonel Requeterán. So another company was commanded by Celso Torrelli, Captain Celso Torrelli, who later became president of Bolivia, and he was stationed with his unit in Higuera, where Che had last been seen, to be able to support if the searching company will find something. And the searching company was commanded by Captain Gary Prado. So they were deployed at that time, and on the 7th, who happens to be a Saturday, my friend especially had trained some intelligence team for the battalion who spoke the Quechua, the Aymara, and the different dialect. And they had moved in civilian clothes ahead of the battalion to talk to the farmers. So he came back, and one farmer told him he got a place there that he was cultivating something, and he saw the guerrillas in there in a place nobody was supposed to be, called El Yuro, Quebrada del Yuro. So that evening, Gary Prado surrounded the Quebrada de Yuro with his close to 200 men. And then on the 8th of October, who was a Sunday, the firefight erupted. A lot of kill from both sides. Che was wounded on the right side of the leg. And then he was captured trying to evade the the encirclement with Willie, Simon Cuba Sarabia, who was a Bolivian guerrilla. And I was at that time, being a Sunday, I was in Valle Grande installing some PRC-10 radios on the Bolivian Air Force combat plane, the 8060, because they didn't have any compatible frequency with the ground troops. They operate in 100 and some megahertz in VHF, and the unit operate in FM, which is about 50 megahertz, so they have no communication. So I borrowed three PRC-10 from the Army. I installed one in each plane so that they will be able to talk directly to the ground troops and be able to support them militarily. I already had terminated training, setting up two. One was still not finished. That's when the head of intelligence came to me and said they had word from the operational area of Papa Cansado, which is a simple code for the head of the guerrilla being captured alive and wounded. Now, they didn't know whether it was really Che Guevara or whether it was Inti Peredo, Coco's brother, who turned out to be then the head of the Bolivian guerrilla on the Bolivian side. So I flew in the back of one of the planes. Mayor Serrate, the head of operation, flew in the back of the other. We flew over the area, and they were able to verify that Papa Cansado was the foreigner, so we knew it was Che.
And so you got the opportunity, and you were the last one to have the opportunity to talk to Che.
Yes, then when he came back, Centeno sent Lieutenant Colonel Shelley in a helicopter, and he was dropping there to try to gather all of Che Guevara documentation so that people will not keep it as a souvenir and to interrogate Che. And that evening that we celebrated at the hotel, I brought a couple of bottles of scotch that I had bought for an occasion like this, and I asked him if I could accompany him, and of course everybody wanted to go. And because of the altitude and the size of the helicopter could only take two people beside the pilot. But we had excellent relationships, so Colonel Centeno spoke to his officer and said, you know, he knew that they all wanted to go, but he also knew how much harm this guy had done to my country, to Captain Ramos' country. And if they don't mind, he will bring me with him. So on the following morning, we took off at 7 o'clock in the morning, a small helicopter piloted by Jaime Niño de Guzmán, a Bolivian major, Air Force major. We landed next to the schoolhouse, and there was Gary Prado waiting there, Major Ayoroa, the executive of the battalion, Colonel Selly with all of Che's documentation. And we came into the room, and he started asking questions to Che, and Che would look at him and say nothing. He was on the floor. He was tied down, arms and legs, and in front of him was the dead body of a couple of Cubans. One was Captain Oslo Pantoja, another Cuban officer. Then they left. I asked him to get all the documentation for my government to be photographed. So he asked Celis to give me the pouch that Che had. He had a big book, diary. Of course, it was written in Spanish, but it was from Germany. He had some photographs for his family. He got a black mask that he used for his asthma and some medicament. He had family picture. He had some code book, numerical code book, that was given to him by Red China. And also he had a little booklet signed by Ariel, message that he received from Cuba. He could not transmit because Cuba sent purposely his transmitter broken. Mm-hmm. But he could receive a Radio Havana, Cuba. And it was signed by Ariel, that we saw it was Fidel. Later on when I met Benigno, Colonel Dariel Arcon Ramirez in Paris, he told me that Ariel was Juan Carretero, who was an intelligence officer in charge of Che's communication. Okay.
Can you tell me a little bit about the historical importance of Che Guevara, like what he meant to the overall Cuban Revolution?
Well, his popularity became later on, by being called Che and being a foreigner, being Argentinian. When he went in training, according to Miguel A. Sanchez, the Korean who trained all of them, he was nobody. I mean, he was not in the top group of Castro's advisor or operator when they went to Cuba. As time went by, because of the name Che and being an Argentinian, that's where he started being separated, distinguishing himself from the other groups. My old feeling about him, definitely, all I have read in the past, that he was an assassin. He was a cold-blooded assassin. He enjoyed killing people. He would not mind throwing the atomic bomb in the United States as long as he could achieve socialism in this country, like he did say at the United Nations. He had a tremendous sense of hatred for the enemy, and that's what he tried to play. Even I think there is a booklet you can find that they distribute in Angola to the soldiers, and they, he talk about being a killing machine, and that they should be moved by hatred against the enemy and implacable. I mean, he was really strong on those feelings. So when I got there, you know, that's the image that I had of him. I was looking forward, you know, to what's going to happen. Nevertheless, when I saw the man, the way he looked like, you know, it was an impact. The image that I had of this arrogant guy going to the Soviet Union or China in a covert coat, you know, and now to see what was in front of me, who looks like a beggar, you know, he was on the floor, his clothes was in rag, dirty. He didn't even have a pair of boots. He had a pair of some kind of leather attached to his foot. He looked like a real beggar, you know. As a human being, I feel sorry for him. And it was a hell of a contrast to what I remember and what I was seeing in front of me.
Yeah, I can imagine you went in, and this is the guy who helped Castro kick you and all your friends and your family out of Cuba. And you're all excited about, you know, you find out they captured him, he's wounded, and you go in, and you see him on the floor. It's just different than what you were expecting.
Absolutely.
You write in your book about the meeting with Che, and at first he wouldn't talk to anybody. And I found it interesting, and this is something I want to ask you about even more than this, about your treatment or your philosophy about treatment towards prisoners, towards people who others, certainly Latin American nations perhaps, may beat up prisoners, may be physically violent toward them. And you even had an instance before this with Paco, who's the man that gave you a lot of the information right about finding Che, where you treated a prisoner in a very different way than perhaps was the mentality at the time. And this is how you treated Che as well, and it really right it really was positive in the end. Can you talk a little bit about that philosophy that you had?
Yeah, I found out that the really treating them well and in humane way, and of course we had the logic and the reason on our side, it worked much better than trying to harass them. Now, it's a different situation altogether. We had never faced before, like today, fanatics like I people. That's a different situation. I have to admit that that's a different situation. But, for example, the Viet Cong in Vietnam that I dealt with, I got to a point I got them to cooperate. Even though I had the help that most of my troops were former Viet Cong, and sometimes a lot of them have known the people that we have captured. But treating them well, with respect, with dignity. Then I went into trouble of explaining to them what happened in my country, you know, to these people and to the different. And they, you know, it's logic to what I was telling them, you know. They should have the opportunity of things. And then everybody cannot be equal because you cannot expect two individuals, one working and one not working, to have the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that has logic to it, you know. So when you went through this process, day after day with them and talk to them, it do take a effect on them. And it was very effective in Vietnam. It wasn't torture, and it was just this type of treatment that dealing with them, and they will be very cooperative. But, of course, I have to make that difference now. Now, with those people, you have never seen people like they did, you know, cutting the head, having a child, right, shooting a man, burning them alive. That's a completely different ballgame.
So when you met Che for the first time, you were with another officer, and Che refused to talk, but when you finally went back to have a conversation with him, you actually did have a pretty lengthy conversation with Che before he was finally executed. Can you talk a little bit about that dialogue?
Yeah, well, we went back when we already went through that mm-hmm. in there. When we finally started talking to each other, I went in and out of the room several times, but I still had not finished photographing the diary, and also had to come out about 10 something in the morning to do a radio contact with Langley. I was carrying RS-48, which is a small briefcase, transmitter and receiver in telegraphy. And I already had prepared the message, encoded and everything, but I had a contact in the morning, so I had to interrupt my talking to him to go to the field outside, which I already had set up. The radio equipment has its own battery and everything, and passed this message over to Washington. And, of course, from there he went to La Paz. And I came back, you know, like I say, several times, and like we talk in generalities, whenever I went into a detail of something that was of tactical interest to us, he would look at me and say, you know, I cannot answer that. But like I said, you know, I pinched him about Africa and the African being poor soldier, and I told him that his people had said that they had 10,000 guerrillas, to which he admitted then that indeed, you know, he was in Africa. And I said, well, if I had 10,000 guerrillas, it would be different, but you are right. They were very poor soldiers. And that was time that I remember that he was doing the talking, and they just executed next to him Aniceto. Aniceto is the guy who had been shot on one eye and brought in, and he was still alive. And then, you know, while I was talking to him, somebody shot him on next room. That's where they had earlier killed Willie, Simon Cubas Arabia. And he stopped. He went like this with his head. I didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. And then he continued talking after that. Like I said, we talk about the Cuban economy. I think we went through that already. The Cuban economy, and we talk about why he selected Bolivia. We went through all of these things. Where did we left off?
Well, I wanted to say, just the one last question I wanted to ask specifically about the conversation you had was how he came across about Fidel Castro.
He would not talk about Fidel. I could see that he had a tremendous resentment about Castro, but he considered me being from the U.S. government after he asked me, you know, that I was not Bolivian. I told him indeed that I was from the Brigade 2506 and working for the United States government. You know, to him, I was a bigger enemy, you know, for his ideological stand. So he will not say anything good about Castro, but he will not say anything bad either, you know, because I thought maybe his mind was a bigger enemy to him than anything else, because being connected to what he called imperialist United States.
Because the conventional wisdom at the time was that Castro had basically let Che down, had not supported Che's efforts in Bolivia.
Castro had to. Castro had no choice. Che Guevara took the line of Mao Zedong. And as you know, the Soviet hated the Chinese as much as they hated the United States. So, like I said, when he went sent to Africa, to El Congo Belga, actually some of our people from their teaming operation went there with the two swift boats that were cut in half and operated in the Tanganyika River. He almost got killed in there. There were six of his boats and four were sunk, and he escaped in two of them. When he went to Africa, all the weapons that he received came from Red China. The Soviet didn't give him nothing at all. He came on a boat from Red China, according to Benigno, when I spoke later on in Paris. And like I said, when he was a total failure in Africa, he went to Prague. He didn't want to go back to Cuba. And he refugee himself in Prague, in a house about an hour, less than an hour drive from Prague, Czechoslovakia. And eventually they sent Ramiro Valdez and Almeida to talk to him and convince him to go back to Cuba. They were going to give him all whatever he needed for another adventure in South America. That's the Bolivian adventure.
Yeah.
When you look at that adventure in Bolivia, you knew definitely that it was programmed to get rid of him. First of all, normally when you go on operation like this, the most important thing is to keep communication with the base. And normally they give two or three transmitters to make sure that he does have communication with the base, because they can fix anything in Cuba to transmit to him, but he doesn't have that ability when he's in the field. Well, instead of giving two or three transmitters, he got only one, and when it arrived, it was broken. He would not even transmit one time with that radio. That's the first thing. Then the second thing is Renan Montero, who was intelligence officer in La Paz, who was assigned to support him. He was the one who actually received all of them at the El Alto Airport and channelized his movement from there to committee. And as soon as that was done, all of them were inside the country. He was recalled to Cuba with the pretext that his visa had expired, and we learned that he had the Bolivian citizenship. So he's the only one who could really help him in any situation, because he had tremendous contact outside in logistics, and he was taken out of the picture by Castro. And then Mario Monge, who had met with Castro 2 months before, when they had a meeting finally on the 31st of December of 66 in Camite, and they celebrated New Year together, he was a total breakup between the two of them, mm-hmm. to the point that Mario Monge told his buddies from Bolivian origin who were there taken by the Peredo's brother and Raul Quispaya, he told them that if they stayed with Che, they were expelled from the Communist Party. He was not supporting that guerrilla. So as you can see, he was sent there definitely to be killed.
You write in your book about the last moments with Che. your mission was to try to keep him alive, but the Bolivians overruled that, and they decided to execute him almost on the spot. It reads in your book that you were able to get beyond perhaps the earlier feelings about Che, the hatred about Che, and have a bit of respect toward him. Am I overreading that, or did you have respect for Che in the end?
Well, you have to have the respect in a way, the way he conducted himself before he died. But then at the same time, you recognize how cruel he was, what a criminal he was.
Right.
There are two different scenes. But he did conduct himself well, you know, before he died, instead of crying or asking for a pardon or whatever, you know, he did conduct himself at the end. And you have to respect that.
Right. So there are two really interesting anecdotes or moments in history at that time. One is Che's watch. Can you talk a little bit about Che's watch?
At the beginning, I thought that I had his watch. When I arrived at the Ligueras, there was a soldier who had a GMT watch. They had all of these Rolex GMT in the area. And this guy who had a GMT watch with him, he told me that he took that from Che. So I had a similar watch, but I had a different band. And my original band went bad, so I bought a better one, but it was not Rolex. It was another make. So I asked the guy for Rolex who didn't want to give it to me. I said, no, I'm going to return it to you. I just want to go inside and check and make sure it doesn't have any microfilm inside the watch. So I took his watch, I exchanged the band, and I gave him my watch with his band, and I took his watch with my band. But then later on, as I went by, I learned, for example, that Gary Prado claims in his book, and there's no reason that he didn't do that, that when they brought Che to him, Che had two watches with him. One that belonged to him, and the other one belonged to a Cuban who was killed, and he was holding the watch for the family. And that Che, according to Gary Prado, make a little mark on the Rolex that belonged to Che, which eventually, as history goes, that he sent that watch as a present to Fidel Castro later on. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Selig, who was dispatched to the area the same day and was left there with a helicopter to get all the documentation from Che, was wearing another GMT watch. And he was telling everybody that was Che Guevara's watch. No, I honestly believe that the watch really was the one that Gary Prado had. And you know, but there were like six, every single Cuban that went to Bolivia with Che had a GMT watch. So there were a lot of watches right. In the area, you know, and like I said, Soldier kept one, Che, Gary Prado took two, Celis got another one, and maybe somebody else have some other watch from
the
Cuban.
So Che's is somewhere, maybe,
yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, the most famous historical artifact from that time period is the picture of Che right before he dies. And, of course, the last picture of Che alive is you and Che standing next to each other.
Right.
That wasn't supposed to happen necessarily that way, was it? I mean, you kind of had to swindle.
You know, I didn't even thought about it, which was probably my mistake. I should have thought about taking a picture with him. But in my mind, I wasn't even thinking about that. And the only reason the picture was taken was that when the pilot came one of those times to bring food and ammunition, he came into the room where I was talking to Che, and he had a Pentax camera from Mayor Saucedo, Arnaldo Saucedo, the head of intelligence. And he looked at me and said, "Mi capitán, Mayor Saucedo want a picture with the prisoner." That's when I addressed Che and say, "Do you mind?" He said, "No." So we took him out of the schoolhouse. I first gave my camera to the mayor, and he took that picture. As a matter of fact, when he turned over the film in La Paz to the station chief, because the head of the CIA station chief, John Tilton, was on vacation in Washington at that time. When he turned the film to them, I had a bunch of film with all the diary inside. This one roll of film, undeveloped, had a little X that I marked. I said, "Look, there is a picture of me and Che, which he is laughing." And the reason I say that when I gave it to him was because I put my hand around him just before the picture was taken. I said, "Comandante, mira el pajarito." That's a saying in Cuba to the kid, you know, look at the little bird, you know, up here. And he started laughing when I said that, you know. I look at the camera. Of course, he changed his expression when the picture was taken. It would be ridiculous that he would be laughing in a camera when he was caught and,
right.
And all of that. So that's the way. And then I took the camera of the mayor, and I really didn't know what was going to happen, but I suspected that they might kill him. And I thought, if this guy had a picture of him alive and he starts showing it around, the government has said that he died in combat, it would be an embarrassment
right.
For the Bolivian government. So that's where I closed the lanes and put high speed, and the other picture never came out.
Well, I mean, that, yeah, there's the picture, the one that final came out, is him looking like he's at his, on his last leg. He looks dour. He looks sad. But you're saying right before that he was laughing because
right.
That's great.
Seconds before that he was yeah. laughing.
The colonel that you were with who brought you down to meet and talk to Che was later killed in Paris right. by the Cubans as retribution for
well,
Che.
They claim when he was assassinated, I think it was in 1975, he had become a general, and he was the ambassador of Bolivia to Paris. And they claim they left a paper claiming Che Guevara's commando. Now, later on, when I met Benigno, Colonel Dariel Arcon Ramirez, I met him in Paris, he told me, actually, that it was done by the La Guardia brothers, were the one who organized the assassination of him and of Colonel Quintanilla, who was the advisor to the Minister of Interior. And at the time, he was in Hamburg, Germany. He was the General Consul of Bolivia in Hamburg, Germany. And what Tony de La Guardia did, who was working with the people in charge of assassination for the Castro regime in Cuba and outside, what he did, he contracted some German terrorists to do that.
The Castros, unfortunately, are still running Cuba. They probably still have an inkling that you are somebody that would be a great target to oh, yeah. take out. Are you worried at all about you continuing to be targeted by the Castros?
Well, I'll tell you, I believe in destiny. When you're going to get it, you can hide under whatever, and you're going to have it. You know, I believe in destiny. And the reason I really believe in destiny was one incident. Well, I have several of them, but one specific that happened to me in Vietnam. When I was in Vietnam, and I took a lot of risk in flying, you know, combat missions all the time that I was there, hundreds of missions for 2.5 years. And my helicopter weighed like 18 different times and went down 5 times. And then there was one specific incident that was nothing of danger about it. A helicopter from the Army were supposed to pick me up in the Echo Pad of Ben Hoa. That's what we have, our CIA group stationed there, to take me to Nave, this naval base south of Saigon, where I was preparing an operation. So I went there to, you know, to get up intelligence and everything and then fly back. So the helicopter was supposed to pick me up at like 9 o'clock in the morning at that pad in Ben Hoa, fly me to Nave. I think it was he had to make a stop in Saigon to drop some soldiers, you know, and back. The night before that to happen, we received a cable from Tay Ninh province. Now, we advised 11 different units. It's all in Region 3, which is 11 provinces around Saigon. And Tay Ninh was one of them on the north north, a little bit northwest of Saigon, next to Cambodia. And the cable, according to the, when they deciphered the cable, it said that there was an encounter with the enemy. There were several Viet Cong wounded, and it said that we had 10 PRU killed. Now, whenever we got PRU killed as Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, we pay the widow 1 year salary, you know, and pay the, you know, the expenses for the burial and all of that. And my boss, Don Greg, told me, look, forget about that, you know, going to Nave, you can do that later, go to Tay Ninh to pay the widow. So I got a, you know, we didn't check, we paid in cash. So I had a briefcase full of piastres. It was 117 piastres per dollar at the time. And that thing was loaded, you know, to pay 10, actually we came to about 10 widows, 1 year each, like 10 years of salaries. Mm-hmm. So I left about 7 o'clock in the morning in Air America airplane, one of those little single-engine planes that can land in 20 feet of land. And I landed in Tay Ninh with my briefcase. My interpreter, who was there, greeted me at the airport, you know, received a message I was coming. And he asked me what I was coming for. I told him I am coming to pay the widows. And he said, what widows? I said, I mean, you sent a message last night that we had 10 casualties. He said, no. We killed 10 Viet Cong. The guy who did the ciphering somehow got a screw up, and he used the code for enemy for friendly and the code for friendly for enemies. Hmm. So it was the other way around. It was 10 Viet Cong killed and several PRU wounded, which I would not have to go there. So I stayed with them, had lunch, and I flew back to Ben Hoa. When I got there, my boss told me, you are the luckiest man in the world. I said, why? Said, well, the helicopter came from the army, came at 9 o'clock in the morning to pick you up. You weren't here, so he took off. We understand he made a stop in Saigon to drop some soldiers. When he took off, he had an engine failure. He crashed, and everybody got killed and burned alive inside the helicopter.
I mean, you've had more than one experience like that. You've talked about the one when you were 17 or 18 when you were supposed to go on a mission and got pulled off at the last
minute. That's when the Martin Perez spent 28 years in prison. The guy who took my place was killed in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. And then in late 1970, Chuckley called me, the head of a station, to tell me not to fly into Miami. I mentioned you that because there was a Cuban intelligence officer defector in Paris who mentioned to them during the debriefing that the Cubans were preparing an operation to hijack the plane with the Cuban involved in the assassination of Che Guevara. Mm-hmm. He had no idea who it was. I mean, he just overheard the conversation, and during the debriefing, he mentioned that. So, you know, people from Paris sent it to Washington. Washington knew that it was in Vietnam, so they sent it to Shackley. So Shackley asked me, that was Christmas time in 1970, he asked me not to fly into Miami directly because of this, to fly anywhere else, take a train, rent a car, and they will pay for the difference. So I flew into Atlanta, I rented a car, I drove to Miami. We spent 24 with, you know, dinner with my family, we spent New Year's, and then we stayed until the 6th, which is the Reyes Mao, we call, you know, the Three Kings. And then on the 7th, I drove back to Atlanta. I have a cousin, which still live there in Atlanta today. And she went to the airport to say goodbye to me. I had a flight was supposed to go from Atlanta to Houston, Texas, San Francisco, where I had to wait like 4 hours over late. And then I found out there was another flight an hour later who stopped in Dallas and from Dallas to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And since I carried my own luggage, and at that time it was very easy to change plane, didn't charge you anything, I took the second plane. So when I got to Vietnam, nobody was waiting for me. Normally they send somebody to pick you up at Tong Son Nhut. So I took one of these Lambretta vehicles. Guy took me to the Duke Hotel where I was staying. I changed, I got to the embassy, and everybody looked at me and said, what are you doing here? I said, "Jesus, I was supposed to arrive today. Nobody went to pick me up." And then they told me that my plane that I had, they had in record, was hijacked to Cuba.
Wow.
But at the time, there were a lot of hijacking, so it could have been a coincidence.
Right.
Felix's story will continue on part 3 of this SpyCast. We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.